Chambers and his assassin flowed into place beside him.
"Faithfulness is the key, niece," he said, without turning around. "Remember your pledge."
"Yes, Emperor," she replied as enthusiastically as she could manage.
She felt the weight of the assassin's gaze on her and pictured a sneer on the hidden mouth. Her uncle and his shadow departed, and then the door slammed behind them. Indrat reached a trembling hand to her cup and finished her tisane. The scorching bitterness burned away the fears of the moment. The seneschal returned and escorted her from the room. He oversaw her reclamation of her boots and took her down through the lift. It stopped a level higher than she expected.
"The Emperor wishes for me to show you something before you leave, Fleet Captain. Please, come this way."
They walked through back passages and empty spaces. He explained that after traitors were discovered in the palace, the private areas were emptied and locked away from passage. Only a select few could now access them. Finally, they entered the armory. She'd heard tales of it, but had never seen it. The walls were adorned with beautiful flowing shapes and designs made entirely of mounted weapons. She circled the room and marveled at the craftsmanship. Blades that were centuries old still maintained their edge. Suits of armor stood on racks, from the oldest animal hides to the ritual battle dress of the Injaren line of emperors. Finally, the seneschal took her to a tall cabinet and gestured for her to open it. She pulled the paired doors apart to reveal 8 blades. She recognized them immediately as the Insanti set, forged at the start of the war with the Domeki and gifted to the commander in charge of the fleet. It comprised 2 longswords, 2 shortswords, 2 daggers with ornate guards to capture an opponent's weapon, and 2 knives designed to be hidden on the body. Each of the 8 was inscribed with a word that corresponded to one of the gods. The longswords were named Wisdom and Destroyer, in honor of the father and mother of the gods. The shorter swords, designed for those who preferred a closer battle, or those who wished to pair long and short swords together, were Peace and War, dedicated to the twins, Ibrina and Evran. The daggers were Constant and Change, and represented Gilois, the god of craft and trade, and Leilana. Finally, the hidden knives were Love and Memory. The modern symbols of Trensun and Udagi adorned them.
"These are all gifted to you in honor of your service, Fleet Captain. Obviously, you cannot carry them all from the palace today. Please choose the ones you'll take with you into battle. The rest shall await you here."
Indrat stared at him.
"You say this at the behest of the Emperor?"
She sensed a trap. He didn't reply, only gestured her toward the weapons. Something told her that this moment was a test, but from whom and for what reasons she couldn't hazard a guess. Indrat closed her eyes and stilled her mind. The meditative state she used when considering the words and wants of the gods was the work of a minute to summon. She raised her left arm, the one closest to her heart, and traced an arc in front of her, her extended fingers pointing at each blade in turn as she sought any indication, any hint of the god's will to inform her choice. Her eyes snapped open to find she was pointing at a long blade. She first saw the one labeled Destroyer, but that wasn't the one to which her fingers stretched. She closed her hand around the grip of the other and held it up, turning it so the engraved words caught the light. The blade's name was Wisdom, the hallmark of the High Father. Certainty washed through her. She handed it to the seneschal and removed her back sheath, discarding it in favor of the double version that was part of the set. She accepted the return of her new sword and slid it smoothly into its home. Indrat chose 4 more blades without hesitation. Into the sheath on her back, she stowed the short sword, Ibrina's Peace. She donned a waist sheath for the dagger of her choice, Change. Finally, she took both hideaway blades. Once the knives were secured in their camouflaged wrist sheaths, She felt a sense of completion, of rightness, of finality. She turned to the seneschal and noticed his ramrod posture had relaxed, and a look of burgeoning hope had replaced the grimace of dismay and fear he'd worn before. He held up a small rectangular device and activated it.
"Fleet Captain, this will allow us only seconds of privacy before someone comes to investigate the malfunction in the armory's cameras and microphones."
He gestured up at the corner where a tiny dark spot stood out against the polished wood.
"I must tell you about the battle to come. The Emperor has planned something terrible."
Chapter 26. The last time Cross had been in the cavernous space, he'd found the atmosphere dark and dour. They'd been faced with the question of how to respond to the aliens' attacks on the colonies, a literal existential crisis. Then he'd imagined things couldn't feel more serious. He'd been wrong. This time, the ship captains assembled numbered fewer than before. The admirals maintained the same level of representation. Floating cameras at multiple locations were trained on the assembly, ready to send the discussion and decisions out to those ships still mopping up alien incursions on their territory. Even with Kate beside him, the stillness was so oppressive that Cross couldn't bring himself to speak. Admiral Wilder stood and paced to the center of the circle of seats. He paused there, then placed his hands behind his back.
"I ask that we open this gathering with a moment of silence for the sailors, soldiers, marines, and colonists lost to the enemy's attacks, and our response to them."
During the quiet time, Cross thought about Janik and the fear that came when you knew those you loved were vulnerable. Kate's ability to take care of herself was greater than ever, and still the worry nibbled at him. How much worse must it be for his chief, whose partner was essentially stranded on a ball of dirt, hoping to escape the notice of their brutal enemy? The admiral dropped the salute with which he'd begun the moment of silence and began pacing a circular path as he spoke.
"Thank you once again for being here together. Those captains and commanders who are currently occupied with finishing up the alien attacks on our colonies are present by broadcast. And I thank you for your time as well."
As he walked, he met the eyes of those in the audience.
"This war has cost a great deal and has gone on far too long. The enemy has routinely identified and exploited our weak points and succeeded in pushing us all the way back to the threshold of our own origin before we could bring them to a halt."
Wilder turned and reversed course.
"But stop their advance, we did. When the aliens threatened Earth, our people responded. We joined together in truth, abandoning the petty divisions that have ruled our relationships with one another since we began exploring the universe. As a single people, we delivered a stinging defeat to the enemy."
He stopped pacing and raised one hand.
"Sure, we had some luck. Chance is always a factor in warfare, no matter how our strategists would prefer to pretend otherwise."
He dropped his arms and raised the other.
"There are those who say that we could have won a more decisive victory, instead of allowing the command elements of their invasion to melt away in front of us. Could have, would have, should have."
He shook his head and clasped his hands at his back again.
"Perfect isn't an achievable goal, people. Our mission, our only purpose, is survival, at almost any cost."
A murmur broke the stillness of the audience at his words, and he raised a hand again to forestall any comments. His expression grew sterner, and the lines on his face etched even deeper, if such a thing was possible. Wilder's eyes were as intense as lasers, and Cross imagined residual heat when they swept across him.
"I say almost, because there are some depths to which we will not sink. Our enemy has tested our resolve, and we've discovered our limits. Never would we attack innocent colonies. Never would we abandon our own. Instead, we walk the fine line that our species has always walked. We choose the difficult path. We choose the hazardous path.
We choose the only path to success that allows us to continue to call ourselves human. He moved to the exact center of the space and stood in the shaft of light that shone down from above. Our enemy tried to make us abandon our humanity. Our enemy failed. Now it's finally time to teach them the error of their ways. He let the statement hang, then gestured for Admiral Silva to replace him. The mustachioed head of the engineering division walked to the center with an abundance of energy and an unexpected grin on his face.
First, a report on our defense of the colonies. We lost a few, but our strategy worked extremely well to protect the majority of our people. We also managed to inflict some significant damage on the Bloody Birds. Not perfect.
He gave a nod to Admiral Wilder, then continued.
But undeniably a success. Now the time has come to build upon it.
He frowned up at the cameras and said,
Those of you not physically present will have orders transmitted to you shortly.
The cameras' tally lights stopped glowing, and they departed from the room. Once they were gone, he gestured for the activation of the holodisplay. While it materialized, Cross felt something inside him loosen. Fear, guilt, nervousness that he'd be called out. He had no way to identify what it was that left him. Moreover, he didn't care. His good actions and his responses to his mistakes told the story of who he was. The mortar of war had ground away his concern for his image against the pestle of experience. His goals, murky once before, were now crystal clear. Protect his people. Defeat the Zhroshin. Go exploring with Kate. For the first time since applying to the academy, Captain Anderson Cross had no doubt in him. Fleeing with the doubts were his fears, leaving room for only confidence and purpose. The display finished drawing itself, and Silva stroked his mustache once more before launching into an animated briefing.
We have more ships here than ever before. By the time we've fully assembled, our fleet will number above 400 decks.
There were whispers and sounds of surprise at that.
Admittedly, this includes everything from our flagships down to our smallest supply vessels. But we will hold back nothing in our effort to defeat this enemy who wants to destroy us. Our forward probes have determined that tunneling beyond the asteroid field surrounding their system is too dangerous. The forces of gravity within it are unpredictable and could skew a tunnel entrance just enough to launch us into the rock. We'll deploy at 3 locations in order to spread their defenses.
3 areas shimmered on the display to indicate landing points.
All 3 assault groups will be capable of standing alone and taking the battle to the enemy. However, one of them will be considered our main attack force.
The image zoomed in one end of the system. Silva's voice took on a note of palpable excitement.
The engineers analyzing the asteroid field have discovered an area that is the same as those around it to the naked eye, but is slightly weaker under heavy scan. We anticipate this will give us a faster breakthrough, and we're going to exploit it for our primary assault.
The display showed wireframe versions of human ships firing upon and clearing the weakened spot, essentially opening a portal in the protective wall.
Given the bird's history of unexpected surprises, we'll obviously guard against the possibility that this is a trick to blunt our attack. However, the engineers doubt that likelihood, and it's too great an opportunity to pass up in any case. If it is a trap, we'll use our skills and numbers to turn its back on the aliens.
The image zoomed to show the other areas.
In an effort to provide the main group with a modicum of protection, the other assaults will attack several minutes earlier, along with a decoy effort at position 3 that'll appear to attempt to blast through a wider swath of rock barrier. After they respond to those incursions, we'll unleash one of our own surprises. Smash open the hole, and fire our primary assault force through.
Silva laced his hands before him with a nod and returned to his seat. Admiral James Okoye, his tall, thin form conveying absolute certainty and strength by his perfect posture, replaced him in the spotlight.
"Once inside the system, we anticipate that only if we're incredibly lucky will we face even odds. The strange mathematical constraints that appear to have been in play during this war are unlikely to continue in the defense of their home planet. Of course, should they wish to not commit their full resources, we'll happily accept that outcome."
He smiled, and a smattering of laughter echoed in response.
"We have plans for every scenario, and more plans behind those. However, our lack of experience in attacking an enemy's home world, as well as our lack of knowledge about this enemy, despite the last 20-odd months of battle, is going to make this assault a matter of fluidity, improvisation, and seizing opportunities where they present themselves. The hierarchies of squadrons and commanders will be waiting for you once you reach your ships."
Okoye paced slowly as he spoke.
"Finally, we're aware of a number of enemy listening posts throughout our territory, including one that hides at the very edge of this sector. We've believed for some time that the aliens were intercepting some of our transmissions, and so we've undertaken a campaign of disinformation. The final piece of that effort will be a broadcast at an appropriate security level that orders our ships to different gathering locations. 6 of them, in fact, to be ready to mount our assault starting in 36 hours. These orders will instruct you to depart immediately for these assembly points."
He looked around, making sure that every eye was watching him.
"This missive is a lie. You are to return to your ships and depart according to the instructions you will be handed as you leave. Our launch for the assault on the alien home world happens within the hour."
The energy level in the room spiked, and aides came forward to guide the various captains and commanders to separate exits to better facilitate the distribution of their orders. Now that the moment had arrived, Cross's stomach dropped into his feet. He turned to Kate and saw a look on her face that suggested hers was being unruly as well. By unspoken agreement, they raced to a darkened and forgotten corner. Once there, they stood, unexpectedly awkward with one another. Kate shook her head and said,
"Screw the rules. They can bust me down to Ensign if they want."
She pulled him into a kiss, and he returned it with all the promise and love he could muster. They ended the lip lock and moved into a full-strength hug.
"You stay safe, and come back to me, Red."
She returned his whisper with a quick,
"Same to you, Ace."
They broke apart, and Cross patted his tunic over his heart, pushing the cadet insignia pinned inside against his skin. Kate reached up and touched her pendant with a nod, then began to walk away.
"Kate," Cross said,
and she looked back over her shoulder. He was forced to yell over the confusion of the room. He didn't mind.
"I love you."
She nodded and mouthed,
"I know."
Then was lost to the teeming officers. Cross broke into a grin at the shared reference and headed for his own door. Their perfect rightness banished his worry. They would be together. Call it chance, call it fate, call it destiny, call it the stubborn intransigence of two people who'd chosen one another. There was no way the damned birds would separate them. He'd destroy them, one at a time, with his bare hands if need be. He grabbed his orders and ran for the Washington. Chapter 27. The sight that greeted Captain Anderson Cross as the Washington, D.C. emerged from tunnel space was unprecedented. A little more than a third of Earth's ships were arranged in a wide swath, facing the asteroid field that encased the enemy's home system. Ahead, earlier arrivals were already laying laser and plasma fire into the giant rocks in an even spread across the weakened area. The plan was to weaken it all, then punch through in a sudden rush. The main display updated with feeds from the command squadrons. A section of the screen was devoted to a new schematic generated by the Rio, which held the responsibility of coordinating the entire assault. It looked down upon a two-dimensional representation of the battle, calling to mind a game board. On it, small triangles representing human vessels clustered in the three pre-planned locations with more appearing each second. Another section of the monitor showed him the status of the ships under his command. They were a squadron of 8 cruisers, joined by an unofficial 9th, as Kate and the Pandora swung in on the Washington's 5 o'clock.
"Let's do it by the book," Cross said. "Helm, ready," replied Lieutenant Lee. "Tactical, ready," replied Matthews.
The checks went on, with each station on the bridge and throughout the ship reporting they were prepared for battle. There was a single moment of levity when Gunnery Sergeant St. John responded,
"Playing cards,"
but everyone knew their Marines were always ready, verifying it was just an exercise in redundancy.
"Excellent," Cross said. "Fitzpatrick, let's see our squadron commanders, please."
He sent the Washington status report to the Chicago, designated lead for the main assault force, and looked up again in time to see his squadron mates appear on the screen. He stood, adjusted his uniform, and ran a hand through his sandy hair.
"Captains, commanders, our squadron will operate in pairs, so each ship has a wing. Our main job is to work with your wing to safely attack the enemy. This promises to be a long battle, even if everything breaks our way, and every minute a ship is alive is one more minute in which it rains destruction on our enemy. Tianjin, you're with the Washington. Saskatoon and Jakarta, you're together. Kilkenny and Manila, you're a team. And Panama and Rostov, you look out for one another."
He'd been careful not to pair ships from the same service. The AAN and the UAL would need to come together, as they had in the battle to preserve Earth if they were to win. And it would start right here.
"The Pandora will be our wild card. If she calls for your assistance, unless I've given you a specific task, break off your engagement and aid her."
The heads on his screen bobbed in affirmation.
He spread his hands out. "The assault is enormous, but our fights are the same size they've always been. A few of us versus a few of them. I guarantee you, we're better. Let's go make sure they understand that, too. Remember, stick with your wing and call for help if you need it. Cross out."
Fitzpatrick killed the connection, and he sat back, rocking to get comfortable. Even without fancy adaptive cushioning, the captain's chair on the Washington felt exactly right. He activated the automatic restraints and slipped on the manual ones as a backup. He took a deep breath and expelled it slowly. The tension on the bridge hung until his weapons officer complained,
"This is boring. Can we shoot something?"
Cross wasn't sure who lit the first chortle escape, but in moments laughter had swept the bridge, and his people were smiling.
"Soon enough, Walsh. Soon enough."
Cross waited and watched the diagram in one corner of the screen as the human ships at the front chipped away at the rocks that protected the Droshin system. There was a soft chime, and most of the screen was taken over by the image of Admiral Wilder, seated in the tactical command center aboard the Rio. He stared gravely out at them, with not a hint of doubt or mercy in his eyes.
"We are all ranks. We are all nationalities. We are sailors, soldiers, and Marines."
He paused and spread his hands before him.
"Our road to this moment has been beset by countless challenges and countless mistakes. From the outset, we were foolish, carrying our grudges with one another up the gravity well and out into the universe beyond our home system."
He slammed a hand down on the arm of his chair.
"And then we compounded our stupidity again and again. We built new ships to fight among ourselves and considered the losses acceptable as we battled over the tiniest parts of this gigantic universe. Every one of us was foolish. From the greenest ensign to the most experienced admiral."
He smashed the other hand on his chair.
"And from our stupidity grew the greatest mistake of them all. Interference with a more advanced alien race. We played our little games, confident the outcome would be the same as always, unaware that the table stakes had been raised far beyond our ability to pay them."
The old Cross would have flinched at that. Now his error was properly in perspective, and he felt no need to apologize. If others wished to judge him, so be it. His job was to keep his crew safe while they kept humanity safe, and he'd do whatever that task required, regardless of what anyone thought. The Admiral lifted his hands, his palms red from the impacts.
And so, we've fought, and we've bled, and we've died. Good men and women, on the ground and in space, lost to this war. A war we caused with our lack of understanding. In our insular experience, we thought we knew it all. At great cost, we've learned the error of our beliefs.
The Admiral stared into the camera pickup as if he knew he was reaching into the souls of everyone watching.
But we've learned other lessons as well. We've learned the things that divide one group of humans from another are paltry, useless predilections. We've learned that we have no need for such things. And so we've learned to let them go and see them burned away in the fire of this war. Where before we were divided, now we are united. It's only this revelation that gives us this opportunity to eliminate the threat the aliens pose to our survival. Alone, we would have fallen. Together, we now stand.
He leaned back slightly and placed his hands gently on the arms of his chair.
As you fight, remember what you fight for. You fight for the safety of every colonist scratching out an existence on a new planet. You fight for the safety of those who couldn't bring themselves to leave Earth and explore the cosmos. You fight for our survival in this moment. Even more importantly, you fight for our future. When we've defeated these aliens,
his mouth twisted, and he stopped speaking for a moment while he mastered himself.
When we defeat these aliens, and I absolutely guarantee you that we're going to kick their asses so hard up between their shoulders, they won't know which end is up for a month of Sundays. We're the ones who'll take the message of unity to our people. We'll be the living proof of what a united humanity can accomplish. We'll rebuild that which needs to be rebuilt. And we'll go forth into the universe to find other species. We'll meet them with an empty hand of friendship. From today and forever, we are one people. We'll welcome those who seek peace with us, and we'll put the ever-loving smack down on anyone who chooses to threaten us.
Cheers emanated from the lower decks, loud enough to make it through the cracks and crevices of the old ship and reach Cross's ears. It was very hard to control the grin that threatened to undermine his captainly demeanor.
Enough talk, Wilder said, and clapped his hands together. Follow your orders. Do your jobs. Remember why we're here. Remember what's at stake. And I promise you, we will not fail. Wilder, out.
Okoye's voice replaced the other admiral's seamlessly as the main display reverted to a real-time view of the system, plus the battle schematic and the strategic display.
There are indicators of enemy activity beyond the field. It's clear that they're waiting just inside the rocks for us. When we break through, each squadron will focus on the assignment that's been transmitted to you. In the hope that our little disinformation campaign worked at all, we're not giving them any more time to figure things out. The other two locations will take a little longer to punch through, but we're not going to wait.
The strategic display updated with vectors for each of the squadrons heading into the weakened area of the asteroid belt. Okoye said,
Energy weapons are taking too long. In 15 seconds, all of our missile decks will fire into the field. Squadrons will form up in three ranks of four and fire energy weapons at the field. Once we make a hole, we'll break it wide enough to go in at least two squadrons abreast, in pairs. And we race through. On the other side, I'll deploy reserves to keep expanding the opening while we take on the enemy forces.
There was a pause, and Cross was about to speak when he was cut off.
Captain Cross, Commander Flynn, Commander Martin, this message is just for you. You are my headhunters. If you see vital targets, don't wait for permission. Once we get in, you're clear to mix it up with the birds. It has been my pleasure to serve with each of you. Stay safe, and drinks are on me when it's over.
Cross swallowed the lump in his throat and said,
Flores, Matthews, make sure our squadron connections are as they should be. Captain Hiroshi,
Are you on this channel? The commander of the Tianjin, his assigned wing, answered immediately.
Sure am, Captain.
Captain Hiroshi Ishana was one of Cross's favorite members of the allied Asian nations. Dima had introduced the two of them, and they'd struck up a fast friendship over their bizarre and passionate love of films from the 20th and 21st centuries. Hiroshi was especially fond of westerns, and slipped into an accented Texas drawl at odd moments. It hardly ever failed to make him bust out laughing.
"I have only one thing to say to you, Hiroshi," Cross said in a gravelly tone. "Yes, Hoss," he replied. "Giddy up!"
He pointed at Lee, and his squadron exploded into motion. Chapter 28. It was fitting, Cross thought, that the Washington, D.C. should be among the first ships to enter alien territory. He watched as the squadrons in front of him opened a gap that met the admiral's conditions. Okoye's voice sounded as the last obstacle was eliminated.
Fort 1, squadrons 1 through 8, advance as planned. 9 and 10, continue opening the passage.
Cross commanded Squadron 5, and his ships trailed the paired approaches of 1 through 4. The front groups continued to hammer on asteroids as they came into position, widening the gap for those that would follow. He got an unobstructed view of the enemy, and his jaw dropped open. Ships of countless kinds and a range of sizes scurried in space before him. Their weapons stabbed out at the encroaching humans the instant they were in range, and the battle was on. Before he could attack, the trap the aliens had set for them was sprung.
"Evasive!"
Cross yelled, as the asteroids, which had been slowly spinning and sliding through their individual patterns, suddenly became self-determined. Scores of the giant rocks came under power and accelerated toward the human forces. The Rio shouted out its own warning, but it was impossible to avoid the attack. The forward elements rocketed through the gap before the asteroids reached them, but found themselves bereft of support as others blasted into the trailing ships. There was no subtlety, just a huge mass under power ramming into the human ships. A seemingly endless number of rocks crowded the passage. Cross assumed that slowing the followers down enough to finish off the front rank was the enemy's goal. Cross assumed wrong. The explosives set deep within the asteroids detonated, filling the space with additional concussion damage and flying shrapnel to batter everyone's shields. The first ship to explode set off a chain, and by the time the ships behind them had cleared every autonomous rock from their path, more than 20 decks out of Force One's total of 127 had been lost.
"Keep it together, people. This changes nothing,"
Cross said over the squadron channel. He barked,
"Lee!"
And his helm officer threw the Washington into a sliding roll to avoid the sparking remains of a UAL cruiser as it spun past them. Cross's eyes narrowed as his adrenaline spiked, and the noise and uncertainty around him fell away, replaced by a singular focus. Then, his group was through the rubble, and a wealth of targets opened before him.
"Break it up," he commanded,
and his squadron split into pairs to seek opponents. Cross didn't immediately dive in, but watched as the battle display populated with ship types and locations. He pointed at one.
"There," he said. "That's a rammer with what looks like an escort of 6 or 7 cruisers. Kate, let's go after the rammer. The rest of you, once you're done with your current engagement, come and join us. Let's get that thing off the board before it causes trouble."
He didn't wait for confirmation, but ordered Lee onto a new heading to intercept the rammer.
"Give us a target, Kate," he said,
and seconds later an impact marker appeared on the enemy ship. In preparation for the battle, Pandora had been continually analyzing the Zhroshin vessels to find their most likely weak spots. It was guesswork, even for the computer, but it was better than anything else they had at the moment.
"Matthews, verify the whole squadron has the mark. Walsh, let's send in some torpedoes at the rammer, but as soon as we're near a cruiser, unload everything we have at it. Ideally, pick one that's already engaged. Maybe we'll get lucky and the shields will be imbalanced."
He received a nod from the weapons officer and turned back to the screen. In the lower corner, the strategic overview showed the human forces nearing the inner edge of the asteroid field in the other two attack locations. The existence of the Zhroshin vessels awaiting them was a given, but the humans' sensors couldn't identify any details yet. Cross switched to the channel he shared with his wing.
Tianjin, follow our lead. Cruiser first, then rammer if the opportunity is there. Gotcha. We're on it, Captain Hiroshi replied.
Cross waited with a complete lack of patience at the distances closed, and then they were in the mix. Torpedoes rocketed out toward the rammer from the bow tubes, accompanied by a spattering of laser and plasma. Lee jerked the ship to the right, and Walsh fired the port broadside at the cruiser he'd chosen. The Tianjin fired at almost the same moment, then both ships rolled to bring their other broadsides to bear. A double-double serving of missiles and energy forced the enemy ship to break off and flee, but the aliens' reactions were just an instant too slow. The squadron claimed its first kill as the cruiser spun out of control into the enemy next to it. Kate swept in with a battle cry and speared the second ship with a full barrage of sustained energy, her gimbaled weapons tracking as the Pandora flew past and seamlessly switched to aft weapons to keep up the assault. It was too much for the reeling vessel, and it exploded. While they fought, the rammer had set its sights on a member of Cross's squadron that was embroiled in a three-on-two battle. The trio of enemy ships wasn't giving an inch and dove in front of the Saskatoon every time it tried to get out of the triangle they'd formed.
Little help,
Cross said on the squadron channel, and marked one of the three. It quickly took energy blasts from half the ships in his squadron, plus the Pandora, and torpedoes followed. The trapped members of his team accelerated at the marked ship, and it hesitated, torn between running and continuing to block them in. Its hesitation cost it the chance to outrun the missiles. It came apart at the seams, and Cross's ships escaped through the debris, evading the rammer that passed within a score of meters of their tails.
Yes, Cross enthused. We're up 3-0. Great job, folks. Incoming, Matthews yelled,
and the Washington changed course erratically, a sign that Lee had been alarmed enough to trigger computer control for a moment. Cross was thrown hard against his restraints and felt the torque of the motion as each of his bones tried to leap out of his skin at once. The ship was rocked by repetitive concussions as missiles rained down upon her. The real-time view showed the same thing happening to the rest of his group, where they'd surrounded the rammer again.
What the hell, Matthews? He asked. He followed up with, Squadron, spread to max range, but stay in pairs. Make it harder for those bastards to target us.
The icons shifted on the screen in response to his command.
It's those damned alien missile boats, Captain. There's a ton of them at the back of their lines, and apparently they've figured out how to hide the torpedoes from our sensors.
Pandora's gentle voice joined the conversation.
I was unable to sense them until the last instant as well. However, I believe I can provide greater warning now that I know what to look for.
Cross nodded.
Great, Pandora. Thanks. Matthews, set that up.
He turned to take stock of the display again. Four enemy cruisers remained near the rammer and harassed his squadron as they poured fire into it. The giant battering ship moved sluggishly, rotating on its center point as its momentum carried it forward before applying thrust to bring it back toward one of his ships.
Kate, is it worth ramming this thing so we can move on to bigger prizes?
We've discussed that and had decided to reserve the armor for an emergency. This doesn't qualify.
There was no apology in her voice, only a simple statement of fact.
Okay, then. Let's plan a series of strafing runs on that spot that'll keep continuous damage on it. And...
Cross's lower jaw slammed up into his top one as the ship rang like a bell. He spat blood from where a broken tooth cut his mouth and said,
Report!
Medical to the bridge,
was Matthew's first response, and Cross swiveled his head to see that Flores was hanging in his chair against his restraints. Matthews continued,
Rammer is gone, presumably a sacrifice. The Jakarta, Manila, and Panama are all destroyed. The rest of us are damaged.
He hit the squadron channel.
Saskatoon and Rostov, your wings. Tianjin and Kilkenny, you're together. First priority is to look out for one another.
He shook his head and failed to clear the ringing, succeeding only in making the jangling of his thoughts worse.
Holy hell, he breathed as sparkles on the screen caught his eyes.
All around the battlefield, rammers were detonating, taking the human ships engaged with them out of the fight. The lucky ones began to limp back toward the protection of the squadrons that had just come through the gap. Okoye's voice overrode the other comm chatter.
Force One, retreat and regroup according to Plan Beta. Missile platforms, discourage the enemy from following.
Cross nodded, and Lee adjusted their course accordingly. Small icons representing hundreds of missiles appeared on the screen, on course to intercept the nearest Droshin vessels as they pursued the wounded humans. Most of them broke off, save for a cluster that was coming right for the Washington.
You gotta be kidding me!
Cross's voice started incredulous and ended with a grim chuckle.
You are correct, Captain, said Matthews. It's the Ruby Rain.
Her squadron rocketed at him.
Kate, she's here, he called.
Busy, out of position. You'll have to deal with your girlfriend on your own.
A set of missiles departed from the Pandora and headed for the Scarlet Ship, but they weren't going to arrive in time to make a difference.
Incoming hail, Captain, said Fitzpatrick.
Put the wench on the screen,
he replied. She appeared, and the arrogance that so frustrated him was visible in every line of her reclining body and every contour of her smug smile.
Captain Cross, what a pleasure to see you again.
Her words were punctuated by the impact of energy weapons against the Washington shields. The three ships accompanying the Ruby Rain hung back to allow her the honor of the kill, while preventing his squadron from interfering.
Early days yet, Captain Indrat.
It's fleet, Captain, now, but no matter.
She waved a hand negligently in the air.
A long, long time ago, I promised to claim the death of your ship and everyone on it as my own. Today, I end you and deliver on that promise.
Her image faded from the screen. The Ruby Rain fired and kept firing. Energy hammered the Washington's aft shields as she ran.
Status!
Cross demanded. Matthew's voice was confused.
She's hitting us, but the blasts are weak. They're hardly depleting our defenses at all.
Probably another damn secret bird weapon we haven't seen yet, he growled. Lee, evasive, Theta. Helm control to the computer.
The force of the escape pattern was enough to make stars appear in his vision as the ship heeled over. Finally, the Ruby Rain was forced to break off pursuit as missiles rained down behind the Washington.
Captain,
came the pain-filled voice of the sensor officer. Cross turned to see the medical team continuing to work on him. One arm was clearly broken, but with the other, he manipulated his displays.
There was something else weird going on right there.
I've got it too, Fitzpatrick added. It appears to be a piece of computer code, transmitted on audio wavelengths.
Verified,
Flores grunted. His hand flew across his console and he said,
Okay, it's in a protected virtual run space. We can give it a try and see what happens if you want, Captain.
Cross looked up at the screen and saw that his ship and those of his squadron were in the clear for the moment as both sides regrouped.
Do it!
On screen, a window appeared. It bore a single word, Endbringer. Cross frowned and asked,
We think this is from the winch, right?
It's positively from the Ruby Rain, said Fitzpatrick.
Damn her to hell, Cross said. And you're sure that this is safely isolated, Flores?
Yes,
he replied.
All right, enter her name.
Indrat Vray filled the input area, and as the last letter was entered, the image disappeared, and a male voice, highly distorted and raspy, began to speak. It was unintelligible.
Fitzpatrick,
Cross started, but she interrupted him.
On it!
He drummed his fingers for half a minute while she worked her console, and then the message began again. Though it was still low quality, he could make out the words.
Human, I speak for one with whom you've had dealings. That individual wishes you to know that a trap, one in violation of the moral strictures the gods have provided us is in play. If, at any time during the battle, the situation seems lost, it will be activated."
Cross's eyes widened in disbelief as the voice continued.
"The floating fortresses will be sacrificed, wiping the battlefield clean of all upon it. This action would be entirely without honor and is beneath both of our species. If we could assist in taking this option from the table, we would. However, this message is the limit of what we can do, so the choice is yours. If your human forces win this battle, everything is lost."
Chapter 29. Unexpected commands rang out over the command net. Okoye's voice carried across the bridge of the Pandora, as Kate was sure it did on all the ships in Force One.
"We have a new priority, commandeering the floating fortresses. Squadrons 7 through 9 are to encircle and defend the boarding action on the one nearest the planet. Squadrons 4 through 6 and 10 will do the same against the one closer to our entrance. The Washington, D.C. and the Cancun will supply the boarding parties for their respective fortress assignments."
Kate drove her ship toward the assigned target as all the squadrons of Force One lurched into motion. Other ships swept in to tangle with the enemy vessels in the area.
"The Phoebe will attempt to jam transmissions from both of the installations. Our goal is to keep the enemy from realizing that we're boarding, or, if we cannot do that, to leave them uncertain about the outcome. Once the Marines are on board, support squadrons are to discourage any and all ships that try to approach the fortresses. The command squadron, the missile squadrons, plus squadrons 1 through 3 will continue to push forward to keep the aliens honest. Make no mistake, though the fortresses are now our primary objective, we'll have to rely on forces 2 and 3 to handle the planetary conquest until we're done."
Kate activated the channel for her squadron.
"Well, Cross, he certainly knows how to throw a wrench into a perfectly good plan."
Saint just said something similar, although he used the words card game instead of plan.
Chuckles came from several people on the connection. He explained the message he'd received from the Ruby Rain, and all the levity left her.
"How long?" Kate asked.
"At least 15 minutes, they say. Something about supplementing the gear they'd normally take with some extra toys. They'll be using all 3 shuttles."
"Plenty of time to scrape some birds away, then," Kate said.
"Do feel free to indulge yourself," Cross quipped.
She pictured the expression that would accompany the sarcastic words and clicked off.
"What do you have for me, Diaz?" she asked.
Several target designators popped on the display in response.
"It seems we have an enemy carrier and some escorting squadrons chasing down one of ours."
She squinted at the screen.
"Is that the Beijing?"
"Affirmative," he replied.
"Peterson, open a channel,"
Kate said, and routed her ship onto an intercept course. The image of a tall woman in the Beijing's colors appeared in a portion of the display.
"Greetings, Commander Flynn. I'm Senior Lieutenant Zhuan Tai, in command of the Beijing."
"We noticed you've got some friends on your tail. We'll be in range to help knock them off shortly."
"Excellent,"
she replied.
"That'll allow me to get in position to push them away from the fortress.
I'd expected to see Dima."
The current commander of the Beijing smiled.
"Captain First Rank Petraeff is currently on another assignment. He should arrive before too long, though."
Kate frowned at the woman's cryptic answer, then was startled out of her reverie by the sight of energy lancing toward her ship.
"We appear to be in range, Senior Lieutenant. Talk to you again soon."
"Stay safe, Commander,"
she answered, and vanished.
"Diaz, I think it's time to line them up and knock them down with our new toy."
"Now you're talking,"
he replied.
"We're aiming for both the carrier and the squadron protecting it, right?"
"It'd be a shame to lose the element of surprise without doing as much damage as possible."
"Pandora," Diaz asked, "how many of the new torpedoes will be required if I can get them more or less in a semicircle?"
The avatar of the ship shimmered to life in its regular position beside the viewscreen. She was again dressed in the ship's colors, and now a matching collar had been added to the furry creature that stretched and yawned before settling again around her neck and rubbing its face against her fingers.
"The numbers are imprecise, Lieutenant. I'd recommend using all 8 of them."
"Commander?" Diaz asked.
"I concur."
Kate turned to the holographic projection.
"Pandora, how long to manufacture replacements?" 2 are already in process, Commander Flynn. We should have another 2 completed during the expected duration of the battle."
"Very good, thank you. Diaz, give me a vector."
On her control panel, an arcing path drew itself from their current location to a spot that would put them right in the thick of things. She took precious seconds to verify that no allies were likely to shift into their arc of fire. She found none and threw the Pandora into a high-speed redirection onto the path. Moments later, they were in position and under a continuous barrage from the enemy squadron. Small fighters looked like insects as they changed course to intercept her.
"Come into my parlor," Kate whispered, then announced,
"Firing now."
Her fingers stabbed down at the panel and 8 torpedoes flew free, 4 from each broadside. She watched them curve on the main display and arrange themselves in an equidistant line in front of the enemy.
"Is it wrong that I'm really excited to see what they'll do?" Diaz asked.
"The only thing wrong about it is that we don't have popcorn to enjoy it with," Kate replied.
Then the bridge fell silent as the torpedoes did their work. The new munitions were most similar in human experience to the Claymore anti-personnel weapon. Simultaneously, the 8 missiles killed their main engines and engaged thrusters to rotate 90 degrees, positioning them lengthwise in relation to their main targets. They detonated, sending small shards flying at the enemy. In atmospheric combat, the tiny weapons would have been melted by friction. In space, however, they sped away and spread unhindered. The miniature projectiles were made of an incredibly dense metal. The ship's manufactory produced them first as spheres, then added sharp edges by carving away material. They were small enough the other ship's shields did little more than slow them, as those energy barriers were designed with much larger projectiles in mind. Some of the spheres were stopped by the hulls, but there were so many that eventually they weakened the armor enough to pierce it. Where the tiny bladed weapons met delicate instruments, the instruments were destroyed. Where they met flesh, the flesh was shredded. Each torpedo had thousands upon thousands of the metal motes packed inside. From Kate's viewpoint, it looked at first as if nothing was happening. Then the closer ships and all the fighters in range began to show signs of damage in the form of erratic maneuvers or sudden actions before succumbing to explosions, both large and small. A majority of the shards made it through to the carrier, and after a time, it, too, started to show damage. Seconds later, it disintegrated in a series of detonations. In moments, the brutal weapons had destroyed 9 ships and countless fighters. Diaz whistled.
"Tell me again why these aren't our standard munitions, Pandora."
The Avatar shrugged in a very human way.
"These were developed at the very end of the war between the Domeki and the Zhoshin, and never put into use. These are the first combat launches of them, ever."
"Would our ship stand up against them?" Kate asked.
Pandora adopted a thoughtful pose for several moments, then replied,
"Our shields are designed to operate against projectiles of all sizes and most electromagnetic and gravitic frequencies, Commander. On their own, they wouldn't be significantly more threatening than any other weapon in the Domeki arsenal."
"Good to know," Kate said. "Let me know when the next pair is ready. Load them into the forward tubes when they are."
"Yes, Commander."
She rolled through the fire emanating from the fortress as she neared it. She gently tapped the control panel and blasted gun emplacements on its surface as she flew by. Even as her mind catalogued the dangers and reacted to them, her spirit lifted at the fighter-like feel of the ship under her hands. As she swung around to the far side of the giant sphere, she found an enemy trap waiting for her.
"Triangle!" Diaz called.
I see them, she growled.
The back two ships were already connected to the one in the lead, and the green beam that had been so effective before at taking the Pandora offline stabbed out at her. She slipped sideways, mashing the starboard thrusters to get out of the way of the brilliant lance. It tracked toward her, and she corkscrewed low to lose it, only to be sent in the opposite direction as an enemy fighter closed at top speed, intent on ramming her. The straps hurt where they dug into her uniform as she flipped the ship over and threw it into a vertical climb. She stroked the buttons for torpedoes, and her aft tubes fired, sending the missiles back along the Emerald Line. The front ship evaded, and the glow disappeared.
Let's see how they like this, she snapped.
The Pandora flipped again, rotated along her spine, then dove at a point directly in between the two trailing vessels. She engaged both broadsides as she leapt between them and continued abusing them with aft lasers as she passed. First one, then the other fell victim to the barrage.
Nice shooting, Commander, said Diaz.
She didn't reply, but focused on something in the corner of the display. She saw a flurry of activity around the Chicago and zoomed to magnify the space. The dreadnought was surrounded by Zhou-Shin cruisers and destroyers, plus a carrier. Near it, as if they'd just emerged from its hangars, were four ships on each side that were notably bigger than fighters, but far smaller than cruisers.
Pandora, she asked, what are those? Troop transports, Commander,
the ship's avatar replied. A chill shot through Kate as she remembered the Marines' fight against the Zhou-Shin troops in the caverns beneath the mountain. She slid the ship onto a course toward the Chicago and yelled,
Peterson, connect me!
When the telltale on her control panel illuminated, she said,
Chicago, this is the Pandora. We've identified eight transports heading for you. You're about to be boarded. We're coming to assist.
Negative, Commander,
responded Captain Jennifer Roberts in charge of the Chicago.
We're aware, and we have Marines and sailors on board to defend against them should they manage to breach us.
But Captain,
she began, only to be cut off.
Admiral Okoye says to tell you that your task is more important, and one way or another, we'll deal with the situation.
Kate pushed away the image and meaning of those words.
Affirmative,
she growled, and spun the Pandora again. Ahead, the Washington neared the base, with a set of escorts clearing a path and other ships on guard in a sphere around her.
Damn it,
she breathed, and shook her head. Again, as she'd been doing since the start of this war, Kate pushed her fears down into a box deep in her soul and locked them away. It was time to take on the fortress, and she'd need her wits about her if any of them were to survive. Chapter 30 Saint watched through the external camera feed as the Marine flight charged out of the Washington's remaining hangar bay. Unlike their previous boarding activity, this carried no expectation of stealth. The three shuttles looked like cannon rounds, black cylinders that terminated in a sharp metallic point. The rockets on their tails came fully alive as the pilots accelerated, and the ships flew in formation with the minimum safe distance separating them.
Shuttles 2 and 3, status?
Saint asked.
Shuttle 2, all green,
Senna replied.
Shuttle 3, all green,
Jeffrey Surfer Baker answered. Saint looked up again at his display.
Is that overlay ready yet? He snapped.
Coming your way, Gunnery Sergeant,
replied the Washington sensor officer. Shortly after, Pandora's best guess at the internal structure of the fortress was superimposed upon it. Saint identified their target location, a giant hangar that had registered on the Pandora's sensors as emptier than the others. It also had the benefit of being nearer the assumed location of the control center than the other hangars. The assumptions were spotty, as even the Pandora couldn't get a clear read through the hull of the behemoth.
Slide us forward, Andrews,
Saint ordered, and the shuttle moved slightly ahead of the other two. He looked at all the information he had available and shook his head. This was an unexpected and undesired wrinkle in humanity's game plan.
Marine flight to Washington. We're ready to go.
Show the birds what we're made of, Saint, Cross replied. You're released to action.
Punch it,
Saint said to the pilots of all three shuttles, and an additional engine stage engaged. They shot forward, weaving when required to avoid debris or energy blasts, but otherwise focused exclusively on hitting their target point. When the shuttle's pointed nose